From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. She has a new CD of demo records and a new book of short stories. We'll sample both and talk with her about her work and about growing up the daughter of Johnny Cash. Also today, learning to play piano at the age of 50. Most people would tell you that's too old to learn, but Noah Adams pursued it anyways. The co-host of All Things Considered will join us at the piano and talk with us about his new memoir, Piano Lessons. TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's Academy Awards, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Craven Images, the new satirical novel by Alan Eisler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash was starting out in the early 80s, she was part of the New Country movement. She's had 11 number one country singles. One of those singles won a Grammy. In the New York Times, she was described as the most compelling singer and songwriter to emerge from the progressive wing of country music. But she has a genetic connection to country music's past. She's the daughter of Johnny Cash. Her parents separated when she was 11, and Roseanne stayed with her mother in Southern California. Now Roseanne Cash has written her first book, a collection of short stories called Bodies of Water. Before we talk and hear a reading, let's listen to a selection from her new CD. It's called 10-Song Demo, and it is what it says, an album of recent demo records. This is her song, Price of Temptation.
Standing on the edge tonight, don't know if I'll fall or fly, but that's the price you pay. Temptation, there's no other way. Through temptation, that's the price you pay. Well, I'll let the rivers cry through my eyes and watch myself go crazy with desire, but that's the price you pay.
Roseanne Cash, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why is your new CD a CD of demo recordings as opposed to, you know, big studio productions?
Well, it was going to be a big studio production, and I was just, my husband John and I were putting some songs down at his studio, and I sent them to Capitol, my new record label. I just moved from Sony, to let them know what I was going to record for the first album, and they said, let's just release them like this. So I was very surprised. But I like the idea of experimenting like this and just putting it out very low-key, no video, no big tour, kind of just putting it out for the pleasure of putting it out.
Now, you also have a new book of short stories.
Yes.
And the book is called Bodies of Water. How did you start writing prose?
Well, then that's something I've been doing for quite a while, too. I wrote poetry through my childhood and my teenage years. And when I went to college, I started writing short stories. And I've kept doing that throughout my recording career. It's always held a great fascination and interest for me. It just, I didn't decide to write a book until, you know, a few years ago.
Well, I'd love to hear you read from your new collection of stories. Why don't you read the beginning of the title story, Bodies of Water?
Okay. All right, this is Bodies of Water. This is what I do. I wake up in a hotel, a nice hotel, orchids in the vases near the mirrored elevators. I have been there only long enough to sleep. I order room service and lie to the waiter when he asks where I am from. I go downstairs and get on the bus, purple on the outside, gray on the inside. Nearly all the band and crew have gone to their bunks for a few more hours' sleep. I put Bessie Smith on the stereo and think about her life. The bus we're traveling on is nicer than what she was accustomed to, I'm sure. But the essence of one-night stands and audience chemistry must be the same. Still, when Bessie played Atlanta's old 81 Theater in 1923, the mobs inside and out hung on her every note. But when I played in the same city's Tony Chastain Park last night, the white wine and brie crowd chatted during my entire set, which brought up my no longer existential but constant question, why do I do this? We stop at a Cracker Barrel for lunch somewhere in the Deep South. My body goes rigid and limp at the same time in defense against what? The dirt brown uniforms, the cigarette smoke, my own unpleasant memories. There is a tangible density, a sluggishness in the Deep South born of the heat and a fiercely defended spiritual myopia. I depend upon my traveling companions to smooth the hard edge of loneliness that cuts through my body, my dreams, and sometimes my performances, and I try to soothe theirs in return. I don't know how to love myself out here, and time has not been a helpful teacher in that regard.
Do you consider the story autobiographical at all? The part that you read?
Very much. Mm-hmm. Very much. In fact, I remember that tour. And it was very difficult.
Do you still ask that question when you're on the road? Why do I do this?
I stopped, really. You know, I
stopped being on the road, or stopped asking the question.
Stopped being on the road so much. I mean, I got to the point where I really seriously asked myself that question: do I want to be on the road 10 years from now, sleeping in my underwear with 9 guys on the bus, traveling all night, you know, breathing cigarette smoke and worrying about my voice? And I really didn't. It just didn't seem to have the kind of richness and dignity that I wanted for my life. So I tour very seldom. And now, even as I tell you this, I'm about to go on this book tour, which is the first time I've done this.
I bet the book tour will be a little different than a music tour.
Yeah, I thought it would be easier, but apparently there are slave drivers around here.
You're not on a bus, though.
No, not on a bus, that's true. Not on a bus.
My guest is Roseanne Cash, and she has a new CD called 10 Song Demo, and she also has a new collection of stories. It's her first book, and it's called Bodies of Water. One of the characters in your new collection of stories is writing in part from the perspective of when she was 11.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was a child, she thinks, in the world in which I live, men are regarded to be irredeemable, selfish, and cruel, and women to be unfailingly virtuous. Mm-hmm. I know I can never truly take my place in that picture. Did people give you those messages when you were growing up?
Well, yes. I grew up around Southern women, and there was a very powerful stereotype of Southern women had and believed into, and the men too, obviously, that men were to be somehow redeemed by women, or they were irredeemable. And I know that there's actually some kind of spiritual basis for that. I mean, just to get off on a tangent for a second, that there are some cultures that believe that men achieve salvation through women. Well, certainly not Christianity, but other ones. But yeah, so there was this unspoken message that women were to be good and true and long-suffering, and men were to be wild and, you know, making mistakes and just waiting for a good woman to come along and fix him up. Well, I just knew. I mean, writing in that story, that's very autobiographical, too. In fact, that whole story is the first one, We Are Born. I knew that I could never fit into that, that I didn't believe it, and that I was risking being judged, you know, by the whole ancestral plate there, and that I was going to have to come up with something new for myself.
Well, you know, I'm thinking your father, Johnny Cash, is the ultimate in macho, and had a lot of problems, too, earlier in his life with drugs and so on. Did you see your mother as a person who was supposed to redeem your father?
Yes. I mean, my mother was Catholic, or is Catholic, and, you know, she's very long-suffering and very fiercely maternal. her children were first in her lives, and, you know, thought she could just work anything out with my father. Well, you know, some things can't be worked out. So, you know, it was tough for both of them.
And if your goal in life as a woman is to redeem a man, and you quote fail in that task, then everything is blown.
Right, the whole cover is blown. Then what do? You have to come up with something else.
right. So there must have been some rough periods for your mother.
Certainly, but you know, somehow assimilating that, and I came up with a different answer for myself that I was only supposed to redeem myself.
Which is hard enough.
Which is hard enough, right. Let's just keep men out of the picture until that happens.
In one of your stories, it was the story we referred to before, the character's grandmother makes scripture cake.
Yes.
And this is cake where all the ingredients come from the Bible. Did anyone in your family make scripture cake?
Yes, my grandmother Cash made scripture cake.
And what is it?
Well, it's just that there's... Yeah, I hope I explained this right, but there are verses in the Bible that refer to food, right? They'll mention a food. And so in her recipe, it would say, you know, Leviticus 4:9, or, you know, Matthew 14:2. And you would have to know what the food was that that verse referred to.
To be like 1 tablespoon Matthew 14:2.
Right, exactly. So she wouldn't even have to look it up. She would just know that that meant salt or, you know, flour.
Were you expected to be as conversant with Scripture as she was?
No, because my mother was Catholic. I was expected to be as conversant with guilt as she was.
Was Scripture cake tasty?
I believe it was. I can't quite recall. I know my grandmother was a fantastic cook. I have memories, such profoundly moving memories of her food. Fried chicken and cornbread and coconut cream pie. She was wonderful.
And scripture cake. Roseanne Cash is my guest, and she has a new CD that's called 10 Song Demo. She also has a new book, her first book, a collection of short stories called Bodies of Water. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Roseanne Cash, and she has a new collection of stories called Bodies of Water and a new CD called 10 Song Demo. Why don't we pause here and listen to some more music from your CD? I thought I'd play the song If I Were a Man.
Okay.
And say something about the song.
It's very ironic. One of the lines in it is, if I were a man, I'd change the way the whole world thinks. And it's very tongue-in-cheek because I actually do think I'll change the way the whole world thinks. Without being a man.
Okay, well, this is the demo version released on the new CD. This is Roseanne Cash.
If I were a man, I'd be so sweet. I'd give me everything I need. I'd be so glad to go this deep. If I were a man. If I were the moon, I'd hang so low. Bring sweet love to all below. I wouldn't change and hurt you so. If I were the moon. Well, it goes on and on forever, and there's just no way to know. I can change just like the weather. I'm as solid as a stone. If I were the wind.
Roseanne Cash from her new CD, 10 Song Demo. You've said that you've come to think of fame as something that, that as a child you thought of fame as something that destroys people and destroys families.
Mm.
Is that what happened in your family?
To a certain extent. Combination of factors. You know, my father was a drug addict, but I think it was exacerbated by how extraordinarily successful he was and the pace that he was required to keep and the time he, you know, felt he had to spend away from his family. You get caught up in something like that and you wake up 20 years later and say, oh my God. You know, so I, having seen it from the other side, I was extremely apprehensive about buying into anything of the sort. And in fact, I just wanted to be a writer. I just wanted to be a songwriter and a prose writer. I had no interest in being in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is a struggle for me. I still battle with that concept of doing your work in public and having strangers comment on it and think things about you that you're not in control of, you know. And,
it was particularly hard when your work has to do with your life because your songs and your fiction are somewhat autobiographical.
Right, right. It's a paradox because I am led into doing the kind of work that has a deep emotional thread and
sure, that's close to the bone.
Yeah, and the place I can be most inspired by that is my own life, obviously. I mean, I don't get it from television. So to do that and then to struggle with this concept of working it out in public has been a struggle for me from the very beginning. I'm getting more comfortable with it, though.
Roseanne Cash is my guest, and she has a new CD called 10 Song Demo. And she also has her new book, a first book called Bodies of Water, a collection of short prose pieces. Before you made your first record, I think it was right after you graduated high school, you toured as a backup singer with your father, Johnny Cash.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know the songs in his repertoire?
Oh, sure. I mean, they had gone in by osmosis over the years, yeah.
So what was it like singing backup harmony with him?
Oh, it wasn't real. I mean, people make a thing
about it. It wasn't real?
It wasn't real. I wasn't really a singer. It was just cute. I was 18, 19 years old, and my stepsister, June Carter's daughter, Rosie, and I would walk out and cling to each other like we were standing on a cliff and tremble and sing these two little parts on a couple songs, you know? And it was just a dad bringing the kids out for a little while, you know? It wasn't a real thing.
So it was a way to be closer to him for a while?
It was a way to go on the road with my dad after high school and see the world and play.
I'm sure you observed the country music life. Being
yes.
on the road with him. What did you like and what did you find distasteful about it?
I loved the travel at that time. I loved, you know, the nice hotels. I loved the attention. I loved hanging out in the dressing room and learning how to play guitar. I loved going to Europe and I loved being educated about nice things, you know. And I would watch him every night and just looking at his back or his profile, you know, and see what he was and see how long he had been doing this. And he seemed so timeless to me, as if he could have been a medieval jester or someone from the future, you know. He has this incredibly resonant quality to him that makes him absolutely timeless. And I saw how he related to an audience. It was a wonderful education.
Now, if you don't mind my asking about this, I know you've alluded to it in your work and talked about it before. There was a period when you were doing cocaine. And I was wondering, you know, after seeing the effects of drugs on your father earlier in his life, did you take that as a warning signal that, you know, being on the road and doing drugs was probably not going to be a very healthy thing?
Well, you know how it's like you can't tell kids anything. They have to make their own mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just had to go through it, I suppose. I did. I think my life really began over when I got clean.
When was that?
That was 12 and a half years ago.
Was it hard to do?
Sure.
Did it take you a long time to feel like you were
not white-knuckling it anymore?
Right.
Yeah, it took a while. It took a year.
Were you uncomfortable about listeners finding out about that part of your life? Or?
Sure. In Nashville at the time, there was this huge expose right after I had gotten clean. and they put me and several other artists on the front page of the newspaper saying, you know, these people have used drugs. It was just horrible. After I had told them that I had not wanted to be a part of this article, and they were saying, well, we'll only use you if you agree. And it was incredibly painful that my grandmother, who was 80 years old at the time, and my little children had to see this. You know, I felt like it was nobody's business, that my family had been through enough pain about this, you know, and then it was out there. It's like you can't, I wanted to heal in private.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the whole reasons why I have struggled with this concept of public life from day one, because mm-hmm. I don't feel like my life is interview fodder, you know, it's my life. And at the same time, I feel very connected to people that, particularly people I've gotten letters from who've talked about their own struggles and their own healing processes and what it's been like. And of course, I found out it's not been that different from me, you know. So, yes, I was hesitant about it being public, and I still am not thrilled about talking about it, because I don't want to put myself as some kind of activist about,
right,
you know, because that would just be setting myself up.
Well, Roseanne Cash, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Roseanne Cash has a new CD called 10 Song Demo. Her new book of short stories is called Bodies of Water. Here's the title track of an earlier CD called The Wheel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
How long was I asleep? When did we plan to meet? Have you been waiting long for me? When did the sky turn black? Do you still want me back? I'll pick it all up piece by piece. And the wheel goes round and round, and the flame in our souls, it will never burn out. And the wheel goes round. I am a river with a voice. I came into your life by choice.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, piano lessons. We talk with Noah Adams, the co-host of All Things Considered, about learning to play the piano at the age of 50. It's the subject of his new memoir. Maureen Corrigan reviews the new satirical novel by Alan Eisler, and David Bianculli reviews last night's Academy Awards telecast. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alan Eisler's first novel, The Prince of West End Avenue, won the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction and was a nominee for the 1994 National Book Critics Circle Award. But book critic Maureen Carrigan says Eisler's new book, Craven Images, is more likely to garner him slander suits than literary awards from his former colleagues in academia.
Just like so many lawyers harbor secret ambitions of becoming the new Scott Turow or John Grisham, almost every English professor I know, including myself, dreams of writing a farce that would rival those classic send-ups of the scholarly life by Kingsley Amis and David Lodge. The fantasy is so pervasive because the targets are so temptingly broad. All an aspiring wit needs to do is to scan the pages of any brow-furrowing lit crit journal, and voila, the comic colon-encrusted titles just leap out. I mean, come on, clitoral imagery in the poetry of Emily Dickinson? You can't even make stuff like that up. Although Amis and Lodge were exceptions to the rule, it's prudent to wait until one retires from the hallowed halls of learning before skewering one's colleagues in print. This is the safe route Alan Eisler has chosen. After a career spent teaching English literature at Queens College in New York, Eisler published his first work of fiction, The Prince of West End Avenue, 2 years ago. It was a stunner, a one-of-a-kind novel that made you laugh, even as it drew you into a mournful story about aging, self-loathing, and survival. Craven Images contains some of the darker tones of its predecessor, but it's primarily a frantically paced academic satire in which pompous old farts, intellectual poseurs, and zombified students get their comeuppance. Plotting this book probably kept Eisler sane during decade after weary decade of faculty meetings. The hero of Eisler's tattling tale is the appropriately named Nicholas Craven, a 40-something specialist in Shakespeare who alleviates the tedium of teaching by writing erotic limericks and pursuing his more nubile female students. This is a professorial type it's definitely more charming to encounter in literature than in life. Craven teaches at Moshulu College in the Bronx, a former correctional facility where the English department is housed in a Quonset hut that used to accommodate a string of solitary confinement cells. The novel finds Craven, in the spring of 1974, lecturing on King Lear in a cavernous auditorium. Here's how Eisler describes that performance. Craven circled the lectern and leaned back against the table upon which it stood, a graceful posture, one of his best. "What is the nature of the Lear universe?" he asked. Craven paused, allowed his gaze to travel earnestly over the faces of the students before him. What cared they for the state of Lear's understanding? It was enough, surely, if by the end of the term they all agreed on a common spelling of the Mad King's name. Craven's estimation of his colleagues is hardly more flattering. Chief among them are his chairman, nicknamed Papa Doc, and a crone-like professor of comparative lit who force-feeds Craven medieval aphrodisiacs. In fact, the most genuine scholars Craven encounters are a group of literary strippers who've cooked up a review they call The Bardic Follies. In one of their numbers, they dramatize, with a little help from Freud, the true nature of Hamlet's hang-up about his mother. Through a series of identity switches and plot reversals, Craven eventually loses his job and ends up in England, the land of his birth, the place where his Jewish family found shelter during World War II. There, the washed-up Craven, like Lear, contemplates the wreck of his life. Craven Images is by turns a giddy and melancholy romp that will inevitably suffer by comparison to the majestic Prince of West End Avenue. Eisler can console himself, however, by reflecting on the fact that when Shakespeare himself presented A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1596 or thereabouts, there were no doubt critics in the audience who were faulting him for not writing another play like its immediate predecessor, The Tragedy of Romeo and Juliet.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Craven Images by Alan Eisler. Coming up, Noah Adams tells us about learning to play the piano. This is Fresh Air. It would strike most people as impossible to learn to play the piano at the age of 50, especially if there's virtually no free time in your life. But that didn't stop Noah Adams from trying, and you know how busy he is. He's the co-host of All Things Considered, and he always has another deadline to meet. A couple of years ago, he spent more than $11,000 on a piano and started teaching himself with the help of instruction books and computer discs. He kept a journal of his first year learning to play and adapted that into the new memoir, Piano Lessons. We invited him to join us in the studio at the piano to talk about the pleasures and frustrations of learning an instrument as an adult. Noah Adams told me he first tried learning without a teacher because he had teacher anxiety.
All the adult music teachers will tell you this, the people who teach adults, is that we're scared. We adults, we busy adults, are scared of failure. We tend to be people who accomplish things, and we look at this as a situation where we'll fail. We'll set up a lesson schedule, 10 o'clock Saturday morning, and that sounds fine, and then you get busy on Monday, and you're out of town on Tuesday and Wednesday, and you come back, and the kids are sick, and then pretty soon it's Saturday morning, and you haven't practiced a bit. And you go there, and you're all of a sudden you're back to when you were 10 years old, and you're failing. So that's what I thought. I didn't want to do that. Since then, I've found that teachers are very aware of that. I know a teacher in New York who had a student, a businessman who said, "I will never practice. I want to come 1 hour a week, and I will never practice." She thought he would break down and practice, fall in love with it. He didn't. For 8 years, his only piano was 1 hour a week. At the end of the 8 years, he could play Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag in the original, and he was a happy guy.
Is that all he could play?
That's all he could play.
I think one of the frustrations for an adult learning to play music is that your ear is much more sophisticated than your ability to play. And a lot of the books that are written for people learning how to play are written for children, and they're children's songs that aren't going to be pleasing to an adult. And also some of the children's exercises are not pleasing to an adult. Maybe you could play some of the exercises that you use or have been using to learn to play. An example of one you love or that bored you and frustrated you, whatever.
Sure, let me show you a couple things. Pianos play an exercise devised by Mr. Hannon, H-A-N-O-N, a long time ago. And there's a whole book of these, and people spend a long time with them. Somebody showed me this, and I thought it was to improve physical dexterity. And so I would play it. Down, you can play it this way. And I thought I was doing pretty good when I could play it fast. And then I realized I was thinking about other things. You could almost read the newspaper and watch television while you're playing this. My teacher now has taught me about Hannon. It is not about training your fingers to be strong. We have strong fingers. You know, we can type. If you type, you play the piano. It has to do with sounding notes cleanly and clearly. And there's a whole art to it, and you can get fascinated with it. Releasing one note at the same time you're sounding the other. And it's a good way to warm up because you can let your shoulders relax and sort of get away from the day and get into the piano a little bit. The other thing I like to do is to play what Bach played to warm up with. I've learned to play the Prelude in C major by Bach. This is the first piece from the Well-Tempered Clavier. Standard recital piece. Every child in America who plays piano plays this piece. I saw it played by a man in his early 80s who'd had a stroke at an adult music camp that I went to. And he got through it. He could barely make it to the piano, but he got through this Prelude in C major, and he was a happy guy. It's a nice warm-up because it's just repetition.
Now, what happens when you're practicing and you hit a wrong note? Do you have, like, adult ways of coping with the frustration of learning how to play?
If I hit a bad note, sometimes it has to do with concentration. If I'm playing badly, it's just because I'm not concentrating well, and I'll walk in the kitchen and make some tea.
Mm-hmm.
Make some, if it's in the evening, chamomile tea, and come back to it. But really, the morning is the best time. The concentration is there. I don't play bad notes in the morning.
Noah Adams is with us, co-host of All Things Considered, and he's written a new book called Piano Lessons about the first year learning to play piano as an adult. Noah, I'm going to ask you to read a short passage from your book, and to me this passage is about the absolute low point of learning how to play, your period of greatest frustration.
End of summer, end of August, the piano is blowing up with humidity. It's just not working. I'm trying to learn to play Misty and memorize it through a learn-by-ear jazz piano course. And I've been out traveling for NPR, and I'm just about at the end of the piano ambition. And I'm coming up the Shenandoah Valley, going back to Washington. I'll be home in an hour, tired, wanting a bath and sleep. I realize I'm not especially looking forward to the weekend ahead. And the reason is Misty. The piano listening's been great, but my summertime learning curve has collapsed. I've come to dread the scale exercises. I can play Misty at a slow tempo, reading the dot diagrams, but I can't seem to memorize it. 3 pages of the music stay in my mind. The final 2 will not. I've played Misty too much. The piano's out of tune. Who cares? And I'm not exaggerating. Who cares? You know, it was over with at that point.
Did you think you were going to give it up then?
Yeah.
Why didn't you?
Well, I had 2 things happen. One, I had a break. I was sent to Northern Ireland. This is the time of the ceasefire in the north. And a producer and I and an engineer went there to do some stories. And I had a vacation coming up in Maine. And I had also sent a deposit check to a music camp in Vermont called the Autumn Sonata in Bennington, Vermont. And I thought, well, that was in October. And I thought, well, I'll just go there. It'll be a nice vacation, first part of October. I'll go there and see what happens. If I don't like it, I can just come back home. So that's the deal. Plus, the piano's sitting there. If you're going to walk past it every day, you're going to be saying to yourself, well, I failed at that. My wife, Nina, has a violin, which was, you know, a little pricey, and it just didn't work for her, and now it's in the closet. Well, you can't put the piano in the closet. I think she'll get back to the violin, but you can't put that piano in the closet, so it confronts you every day.
So, but you decided to keep at it, and I guess this adult piano camp in Bennington really turned you around.
Yeah, I had seen, we'd watched Horowitz play in a video of Horowitz playing in Moscow, the return concert when he went there. And I'd seen him play as an encore, Traumerei, a little piece of music, and the credits came up and they said it was Traumerei by Robert Schumann. People were crying. So I loved that piece of music. I thought maybe I could play it because it sounded pretty simple, but I didn't do anything about it. When I went to the piano camp, 20 adults were there. Some people used this as their only lesson for the year. A surgeon, for example, no time to practice, no time really to go to lessons, will come and immerse herself in what's going on at that piano camp, be around people who are equally obsessed, and they all were. Nobody would talk about what they did outside. You wouldn't hear anybody say, what do you do for a living? They said, what are you playing? What are you working on? What kind of piano do you have at home? When did you start? And what do you hope to learn here? And it was an extraordinary thing. 5 or 6 teachers, everybody was willing to give you a lesson anytime you wanted it. A recital at the end of the 10 days, which scared me. I mean, it was just terrifying. And I said, well, I want to learn Traumerei. And they said, well, gee, I don't know. why don't you play this nice Vandal prelude and for the recital? They said, Traumerei is a 3rd-year piece. The teachers call it trauma because it's really hard. And then a teacher near the end of the week said, look, why don't you take this piece of music and learn it for your wife as a Christmas present? And I said, okay, I'll try to do that. So that's what happened. But I got turned around at that piano camp because people loved the music and I could start learning right with a real teacher, and it made a big difference.
Now, you call the Traumerei the piece that has taught you piano.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you to play the piece for us in a minute, but before you do, I'd like you to kind of play for us your approach to learning it.
Oh, gee.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Do you do it a measure at a time, 2 notes at a time, 1 hand at a time?
Sure. Well, one night in Vermont, this is a great music teaching family. the Vanderlyn family of Vermont. And they started this sonata in the fall and in the spring for adults. They teach youngsters in the summertime. Lots of kids running around. They have 20 rooms in the house, and they have 20 pianos. And I was the first time I approached this piece of music, I was in a piano in the laundry room, and they have a piano there, big old grand piano in the laundry room. And I asked a teacher to show this to me, and starts in middle C, which I knew. That's my good note, right? I can get that one. And then play this F. Then there's a chord, and this chord took me about 2 weeks. To get to, and then by the way, do you notice just how your blood pressure, mine does anyway, goes down a little bit when you hear a little bit of music like that? It's just
that's your blood pressure should be going up because you're performing on the radio now.
Well, yeah, but boy, that's so pretty. I mean, Schumann wrote this when he was in his late 20s, and he wrote it for Clara, who he was in love with. And I know that I played it. Schumann died when he was 46 in an insane asylum. I know I've played it more times than Robert Schumann has, and I probably appreciate it more than he did or even Clara did. I mean, I just think it's...
You still love it?
Horowitz called it a masterpiece.
But, and, I know, yeah. Harrison, but you've, like, yeah. stumbled your way through it for a really long time, and yeah. now you've really, you know, got it. But I mean, you...
I never get tired of playing it.
Even though it's presented itself with many hurdles for you
well,
to overcome.
It has within it... the ability to teach you a lot of piano, and there are things in here that a first year student shouldn't be trying to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of toughed my way through it with teachers, and I got to the end of it, and I can play it. And on a really good night, with Nina taking a bath, you know, late at night, and the dog sleeping, I can play it just wonderfully.
Play it for us.
Okay. You know, there's a button I saw at a music camp. I saw a button a student had that says, "I played it better at home."
Right. Well, I think it's awkward thing to have to perform, and I didn't mean a performance to be a let's see how good he is, but rather to share with us the process of learning. And it raises for me a really, I think, major question for any adult who's learning an instrument, which is, what is this about? Is it about the pleasure that music and the privacy of your own room can give you? Or is it about performing? Is it about being good? I mean, do you care if you're good or not? Or is it just about the pleasure of being able to sit at the piano and get sound?
I just read Menachem Pressler, who plays in the Beaux-Arts Trio, and just had, by the way, his solo debut at Carnegie Hall in his 70s. He said the epiphanies, and I agree with this, the epiphanies are in practice. Mm-hmm. They're not in performance. And when you think about it, the rush of adrenaline and everything else that gets you up for other things, the performance pays off. But in this particular situation, maybe he's right. The real joy comes in practice. He said that his performance level was only ever 70% of what he could do in practice. So he's 30% down when he goes to perform all over the world, and I assume in recordings too. So it really is right with what you do. It's the honesty of what you do at the piano keyboard when you hear it yourself. There is a Schumann C major toccata that has in it so many notes that the pianist is playing 24.1 notes a second. Somebody analyzed a recording of it. You know, and when I'm just doing this. And so who cares? I'll never be a performer. Nina, my wife, said, we were talked about, when will you be a piano player? I'll never be a pianist. Maybe I will be a piano player. And she said it's when you can affect someone's emotion by playing it. And I take that to mean my emotions as well as someone else's.
Well, Noah, thanks a lot for talking with us about your new book, Piano Lessons, and for playing for us, too.
I enjoyed it, Terry. Thank you.
Noah Adams is the co-host of All Things Considered. His new memoir is called Piano Lessons. Coming up, a review of the Academy Awards telecast. This is Fresh Air. Traditionally, the highest-rated special of the TV season is the annual telecast of the Academy Awards. Worldwide, it's supposed to attract an estimated 1 billion or so viewers. One of those viewers was TV critic David Bianculli, who, as always, has an opinion.
Most people watch the Oscars, I think, for the same five reasons. Number one, they want to find out the winners, at least for the major awards, most of which aren't announced until after midnight on the East Coast. Number two, they want to size up the host or hostess, to decide whether the monologues and ad-libs are funny this time. Number three, they want to check out the fashions and see who's wearing the sexiest and most outlandish evening gowns. Number four, they want to hate and then grumble about the traditionally awful production numbers. And number five, perhaps most of all, they want to be treated to a special moment. A special moment could be a streaker running across the stage, or Jack Palance doing one-handed push-ups, or Sally Field saying we really liked her, or Tom Hanks delivering a great acceptance speech. Last night, the 68th Annual Academy Awards presentation on ABC provided us with one of those special moments, the moment when quadriplegic Christopher Reeve showed up on stage, received an emotional standing ovation, and bravely delivered a speech. In a quiet but firm voice, he urged his peers to make films that mattered.
When I was a kid, my friends and I went to the movies just for fun. But then we saw Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. It started us thinking about the madness of nuclear destruction. Stanley Kramer's The Defiant once taught us about race relations. And we began to realize that films could deal with social issues. Now, when you look at films like Platoon and Philadelphia, Lorenzo's Oil, you realize the power of film to present painful but important issues to the public.
What about the power of TV to bring viewers a moment like that? There were other special moments this year, too. Mira Sorvino, the Best Supporting Actress winner for Woody Allen's Mighty Aphrodite, thanked her father, actor Paul Sorvino, so gratefully she made him break down and cry. And Kirk Douglas, accepting a special Oscar for a lifetime of work, spoke with pride and with his speech slowed slightly by a recent stroke. This time it was the son's turn to cry, as Michael Douglas watched proudly from the audience. As for the other reasons we watched the Oscars, it was a rather subdued year. The major winners provided us little real drama this time, except for Susan Sarandon winning Best Actress for Dead Man Walking. Whoopi Goldberg as host was better than she was 2 years ago, and better than David Letterman was last year, but still not good enough to be asked back next year. Bring back Billy Crystal, please. The fashions weren't terrible this year, and neither were the musical production numbers, except for those alleged supermodels wearing the best costume entries. If the purpose of the number was to showcase the costumes, why show so many long close-ups of the models? Which brings me to my final point. If the Oscars, more than anything else, are about winners and special moments, why restrict the winners to 45 seconds or less? Last night, they started to cut off the acceptance speech by the Holocaust survivor profiled in One Survivor Remembers, which would have been a horrible thing to do. It also would have robbed viewers of yet another special moment. If you're going to trim fat from the program, do all 5 nominated songs in one quick medley and be done with it. The winners earned their spot at the podium and shouldn't be rushed through their thank yous. That's where most of the special moments are, or could be, if the Academy folks wised up.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting the 3-CD box set People Get Ready, The Curtis Mayfield Story, highlighting work with the Impressions and as a solo artist. This is NPR, National Public Radio.